Hi! If you're a fan of Nonprofit Lowdown, you might be interested in my weekly free newsletter where I send out weekly inspiration for fundraising, notices about any upcoming events that I'm doing, and a cute dog picture. So check it out at rhegawong.com, rhegawong.com. Welcome to Nonprofit Lowdown. I'm your host, Rhea Wong.
Hey, podcast listeners. It's Rhea Wong with you once again with Nonprofit Lowdown. Today, I am speaking with my friend, Shulamit Burr-Laptop, and we are talking about No More Money Shame. Shula is the entrepreneur's therapist, and I'm so excited to talk to her because I met her through a course I'm doing called The Trauma of Money. Shula, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rhea. Happy to be here.
So before we jump into all the questions that we have about money shame, tell us a little bit about yourself and your practice.
Sure. As you said, I'm the entrepreneur's therapist. So that means that I work one-to-one with women entrepreneurs to support their mental and emotional well-being as business owners in an era of relentless stressors that makes you want to lose your crap on the daily. Because running your own business or being self-employed, being a consultant, is an emotional roller coaster. Never more so than now. And when you think about this and our relationship with money, because we're earning our own money, it can be even more of a roller coaster. It's a very intense, emotional, and demanding experience. And I find people benefit from support. And that's why I do this work.
For sure. And even though the folks who listen to this podcast are generally not entrepreneurs in the way that you're talking about, I would say social entrepreneurs, and they're running nonprofits. So very much running.
Yes, exactly. Leaders, people who are responsible at the head of and responsible for the well-being of any organization, anybody in a kind of leadership position. For example, if you're the ED of a nonprofit, you're not necessarily self-employed exactly, but you're not necessarily the direct fundraiser, but you are co-responsible for bringing the money in for the organization. And in my opinion, that's as self-employed as it gets.
Well, I think everyone is responsible for bringing in the money. That is a whole separate issue.
Yes.
So let's just jump into it, because the title of this webinar is No More Money Shame. And can you talk us through, where does the shame come from? Because in my work, I know people have lots of feelings about money. We make money mean so much. We make it mean survival, power, prestige, control, you name it, I've seen it. So where does the concept of shame come up?
I'm just considering where to start, because it is such a big, wide-ranging, as you've pointed out, wide-ranging topic and phenomena. And I guess I'll start with the trauma of money approach, which you are familiar with also. One of the precepts of the trauma of money, or one of the assumptions, is that living under capitalism is traumatizing, because under capitalism, safety and self-worth are directly related to money and constantly under attack when we live in a world where money is everything. And so when your money is threatened, your sense of safety and self-worth is threatened, even when it's not the actual having of the money, but rather your money status, let's say, in quotation marks, is attacked, then your sense of safety and self-worth are attacked. It goes much deeper than that, but I would start there.
So let's just jump one level down, because I know lots of folks who listen to this podcast are women and women of color. And so how does being a woman of color further muddy the of shame
okay.
in relationship
well,
to money?
I would actually take this a layer up. I wouldn't say down. I would say up, because it's when we think about what I just said, if we think of things in terms of a big umbrella, like money and shame and self-worth and safety, I would see as under here, because bigger than that are all the oppressive systems of capitalism, of white supremacist patriarchal capitalism. And if you don't conform in any number of ways, and this is the whole umbrella, this is the big picture thing. If you don't conform in any of those ways that are outlined as having value and privilege under white supremacist patriarchal capitalism, then you, again, your safety and your worth as a human are attacked. And so as a woman of color, I would say I have white
proximity to white privilege. I'm Jewish, so I have white skin privilege. I pass. So I'm speaking from like the intersection of those, but I obviously don't have brown skin. So I obviously don't bump into this situation. So I'm only speaking from an analysis and not from lived experience. And to come back to this, I would say that when you ask me about a woman of color, the very fact that you don't conform, not because you choose not to conform, but because the systems have defined conformity and you're not in there, that's traumatizing as well. It's a direct, you're devalued as a human and your literal lives are threatened, right? That's your safety, your survival. So that's traumatizing as well. And when you're in this kind of safety mode, that approach can impact your relationship with all kinds of things, not just the systems of oppression in which we live, but your relationship with money and with your beloveds and all across the board.
Yeah, where it even begins. So one of the things that really blew my mind when we started this money training was this idea that, oh, we just need to teach people about financial literacy.
Oh, ha, ha.
And,
right.
And they'll have different behaviors around money. And what was interesting to me and what I did not fully appreciate until I started this course and talking to others is the ways in which the trauma that we experience either under these oppressed systems or intergenerationally, epigenetically, or systemically or relationally impact our behaviors. So for example, being a shopaholic would be a good example, right? As a survival mechanism to the oppression that you've experienced. So I just wondered if you wanted to add anything there, because to me that was a
Yeah, sure. Tip. Yeah. So I should contextualize this a little bit to say that before I worked exclusively with entrepreneurs, I was a trauma therapist. So I'm trained and experienced in treating trauma. My awareness of how trauma comes into play is rooted in that training and experience. And again, living under white supremacist patriarchal capitalism puts us in this fear/safety mode. Like my number one priority, and it's a very narrow tunnel when you're in this fear mode, your very narrow tunnel is focused on immediate well-being and immediate safety. On an emotional level, where you might not actually be under threat for your life, but your nervous system, your emotions, the distress is so intense. Just living on it, like nothing bad has to happen to you as a person of color, especially a woman of color, in the everyday world for your distress to be through the roof already just because of the way the world is. So you come home and you're like, I can't even. And you don't necessarily have a range of skills or sufficient access to privilege and resources to make choices that might be more supportive longer term of your organism. So it's a very narrow, it's what have I got at hand now? What's available to me? And for some people, it's substances. And for some people, it's behaviors that change the hormonal, emotional experience in your body so that at least what you're feeling now is not what you were feeling before, which was deeply unbearable. And so like shopping gives you a dopamine hit and that can help you feel better. Consuming alcohol, smoking a joint, like all of those things are totally legitimate and powerful ways to shift the state of your nervous system so that you are no longer feeling what you were feeling before that was so distressing. And I cannot emphasize that while from the outside, they might look, especially a lot of people in privilege who don't understand, will look at people who don't have privilege and be like, they're shooting themselves in the foot. Why are they doing that? It's because it's the only option and it's the most brilliant option and it's the most powerful option in that narrow tunnel that in which they are confined by the nature of the world in which we live and the limited access to privilege which they have. I don't know if this is responding in any way, but that's where it's taking me.
Yeah, totally. And the other thing is, I think it's really linked to shame as well, because if you are practicing these sort of survival behaviors in the moment, and then once you come out of it and you're like, oh, I did
that.
Why did I do that? I'm bad with money, right? It just reinforces this shame loop that you have.
Yeah.
And this story that is disempowering that you tell yourself about. They're right. I'm not good with money. I do all these self-defeating things. I'm a bad person, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is where fault tolerance, or we could call it self-kindness or self-compassion, that when we come out of it, like you say, we come out of the tunnel and we're back to the wider vision, we're more resourced in one way or another, to be able to say, so with trauma of money, there's the two aspects, right? There's reducing shame and increasing discernment. So you come out of the tunnel and you're starting to shit on yourself, to shame yourself, to engage your discernment and go, wait a minute, whose shame is this? And that's a really powerful trauma of money move. Whose shame is this? And to look at, okay, sure, I'm feeling shame in the moment. Something in me is a part of me is feeling shame. And maybe there's also a part of me that's feeling sadness because my resources are so limited. Maybe there's a part of me that's feeling anger at the systems that have limited my resources and my possibilities and that deplete me on a daily basis, right? I'm actually just going to pause and take a moment. And folks listening along, if you're feeling activated, you might want to do this as well, to place your hand on your heart space and take a breath, which I'm going to do because the emotions are coming for me. I'm just especially feeling the anger. And this is, I'm demonstrating now a little bit of the discernment process that a person might learn to go through with themselves when they come out of the fog and into the present moment and into relationship with themselves and start shaming themselves. So folks who maybe want to exercise choice, who maybe want to check in with their capacity to hear something that might resonate with their personal experience in a way that might be distressing for them. I'm not going to go into details, but I am going to refer to some things. And so I'm going to offer folks a moment to consider if they want to continue listening or come back. And I'm going to take a breath. So I'm thinking of survivors of child sexual abuse and even of sexual assault, adult women or folks of any sort who experience sexual assault, who hold shame around it. And part of the work in the recovery is to recognize that it's not our shame, actually, it's the shame of the perpetrator. But because we live in a society where it's supposed to be secret and that we're vilified when, as victims, in quotation marks, people who've experienced harm, name the harm that has occurred to us and name the person who caused the harm, we are vilified for rocking the boat. We ruined his life. We've ruined the family. Now we can't have family dinners anymore because Uncle Bob isn't welcome. And now it's a whole big thing about who's coming and who isn't, right? And you're where if you had just shut your mouth, everybody else would be happy. But in that situation, the willingness to stand up and to say, actually, it's not my shame and I'm not ashamed. And this is what happened. And I'm naming the forces that cause harm in this situation. Right. Bringing this back to money, right? To stand up and name the forces that are causing the harm, to be the squeaky wheel, to be the person who disrupts other folks and their complacency. This is part of the work of trauma of money. We may not choose to necessarily do so publicly, but we can certainly rise up at our own inner dinner party and say, no, this is not my shame. I'm feeling shame. I'm having an experience of shame, but it does not belong to me. The wrongness here, I'm not wrong. The systems are wrong. The banking is wrong. The credit structure is wrong. The capitalist system is wrong. That's the wrongness. The wrongness is not in me. It's out there.
That's so powerful, Sheila. And I love the inner dinner party. I think it's a really powerful tool. What's occurring to me, though, is it's really resonating with me. And I think there is this tension of understanding the ways in which exploitative capitalism hurts and traumatizes us, and having to operate within that system, right? So
sure,
we're both
yeah.
out here having to fundraise. That often means entering into predominantly white spaces and feeling aggression, microaggression or macroaggression.
Yes,
against
yes.
their personhood. So how would you recommend that folks reconcile this? Because what I see is a very high level of folks of color, particularly women of color, just burning out in the field.
Yeah.
At the same time that we need them in the field to be able to do the important work. So what do we do?
All I can talk about, I have no idea what to say to a woman of color. I really don't. I do, but I don't. You know what I'm saying? One-on-one, if I had a friend and they were talking to me about it, I would totally know how to be a supportive listener to them. As a professional, I think it's like way out of my lane to speak to the experience of women of color. So I'm going to take a step back from that and say what, as a person, a mental health professional who works with folks who come into relationship with systems of oppression. I think first and foremost, like folks end up at my door thinking that there's something wrong with them, that I shouldn't burn out. I shouldn't be burnt out. I'm smart. I'm capable. I'm competent. I'm educated. I know how to do this. What is the matter with me? I shouldn't be feeling this way. And I think, again, like we talked about with the Tom approach of decreasing shame and increasing discernment, really identifying what are the systems at play and what impact are they having on me, so that I can understand that what I'm feeling is a normal, in quotation marks, reaction to an abnormal situation. Again, what's wrong is out there. What's wrong is not with me. It's very easy to say, but it's hard to do without company because of the level of emotional distress that folks feel when they are aggressed in that way in the world. And I would also say community is enormously important, because you and me alone in a box just reproduces the individualistic harms. Obviously, our relationship would be different, but the concept of healing in a box by yourself with one other person is deeply problematic. And so I would say women of color who are involved in fundraising for nonprofits need to get with other women of color who are fundraising for nonprofits, because then you can also see and feel with the whole of you when you're in a room of your peers and everybody in the room is going, fucking right, me too. And that's bullshit. There's something that happens in your body when you are, even if it's a flat room and it's a Zoom room, but even more so in a physical room, to see yourself in the folks around you and to have their resonance with you, like the healing power of that is so vital. And those are like the two places. The other thing I would mention is, I think I have his name right. His name is Edgar Villanueva, and he has two great books. It's called Decolonizing Wealth, and is a book and a workbook. And I would recommend reading his, because he shares his experience. He's an Espanol hablante, a brown man in the U.S. So it's not exactly what you're asking about, but his experience, I think, will be enough of a validating experience for people of color navigating these spaces, the philanthropic and fundraising nonprofit spaces, to get some validation from that.
I've had the experience, and I know folks who are colleagues have had the experience of having situations where maybe it's someone who is like there's a microaggression situation happening here. And I think there's this deep take of, oh my God, is it up to me to have to educate this person?
Right.
And I think there's such a deep fatigue around
the
emotional labor of having to right the wrongs of white supremacy and exploitative capitalism. So any strategies that you can recommend for folks who may find themselves in this situation, be like, I don't want to have to be responsible for it.
It's complicated. It depends on who this person is to you and what your intention is for the relationship. I think when you're fundraising and this is a potential donor, it changes the dynamics. I think you have a wide range of choices. It helps, again, to come back to this community. When you know you're going to encounter somebody who's consistently problematic, to role play it with a peer. How am I going to handle this? I'm sure you've seen this person around. If this is like in this particular scenario, you've seen them at a number of other events. You know how they behave, and you can pretty much predict what they're going to say and do. And so you can role play it with somebody so that there's nothing like the power of practice. And to be able to role play it with a peer who gets where you're coming from. This is the real benefit of what we call in the online business world, a biz bestie. In this case, it would be your nonprofit ED or fundraising bestie, where you and they are on the phone or on Voxer or whatever to one another regularly around what it's like to be doing this work. And so you can prep with one another before you come into the situation. You might decide that you want to walk away in the moment if you haven't had a chance to rehearse. It's perfectly legitimate to say, excuse me, please, and just walk away. Just say, I'm sorry, excuse me. I'm sorry is like a reflex I have. You don't even have to apologize. You can just say, excuse me, I need to attend to something. And what you're going to be attending to is yourself, right? I need to attend to something. And you walk away and go to the bathroom and do whatever it is you need to do to be able to continue on with the evening. Another idea that I want to throw out, which is I feel very iffy about this because it is so nuanced and requires support, again, at least one-on-one, but also possibly from community, is this idea of plenty. Lack of anything, whether perceived or real, and I put real in quotation marks because real is even a very nuanced, real scarcity is very nuanced. Scarcity reads in our system like a threat to our existence. And so in the nonprofit sector where I worked years and years ago, I was not in the fundraising capacity, but I'm familiar with the context, is always, there's never enough money. It's always having to do more with less. It's always having to like put something together with spit and Kleenex and make do. And yet we live in a world where there is, especially those of us, like I've lived in poverty other times in my life, and I still, my annual income is around $30,000 Canadian. So that's within the poverty line in Canada. And yet those of us who have had to survive are enormously creative. And that's the case, I think, for folks in nonprofits as well, that we have an abundance of creativity, an abundance of community, an abundance of capacity. Beginning to think when we're face to face with this person who's maybe a donor, that this is not the only donor in the world, that there are other donors, and that I can cultivate in my sense of myself somehow that there is plenty. Then it reduces the stakes around the relationship with this person and makes it maybe possible for you to have a little more breathing space around how confrontational you want to be or not. Because if at some point you decide you do want to say, hey, that's not cool, and I'm just walking away from this conversation, which is different from, excuse me, I want to attend to myself, which is like, you're not calling anything out. You're just leaving for your own safety. You can also say, that's not cool, or that remark is problematic, or I don't want to engage in this conversation further because of the harm that it's causing, which is much more calling out. It's easier to do that if you have a sense that this is not the only donor in the world.
Yeah, actually, I just want to underline that and double click and highlight for everybody, because I like to say not all money is good money, right? And I think we get into this sort of survival mode when we believe that we have no choice. So the truth of the matter is, especially for those of us living in the US, we are living in the richest time in human history. There is enough money out there, and there are other donors out there. So if you're meeting with a donor who really is not aligned with you, who is not a partner, who makes you feel bad, you can bless and release. There's no world in which you have to, that you are obligated to experience and put up and tolerate harm and pain.
I agree. There is no world in which you have to experience pain and harm.
Tula, this is so deep. I'm loving this so much. So let's talk a little bit about money, because I know we went down a couple of rabbit holes, but I want to talk about money specifically. How might you recommend that folks start to unpack some of the shame around money, and then what to do about it? Because I think sometimes, at least for me, and I've been doing this for years and years, I didn't even realize how much baggage I had about money. I didn't even realize how much I had about money until I started unpacking and be like, whoa, there's a lot here. It's almost like a box that you pack full of stuff, and then you start to unpack it. Like, no, I could put all this stuff in here. So, two-part question, how do we start to unpack it, and then what do we do about it?
Sure. Shame is one of the most difficult emotions to work with, and it's one of the ones that comes up most around money, I would say, because of the context that we referred to earlier. And so the very first step, I would say, is to develop some capacity around self-companionship. So like I demonstrated earlier, this sense of noticing that something in me is having a shame experience right now, and I can be in relationship with that. What will often happen is that, and you could even experiment with this now, when you say to yourself, I'm ashamed, and notice what happens in your mind and body when you say, I'm ashamed. And I can feel like a kind of a squidgy, kind of slimy feeling when I say that to myself in that way. And then when I'm saying, I'm noticing something in me is feeling ashamed. And right away, even as I say, and I mean, I've been practicing this since 2009, both supporting people in this work and using this work as a lay practice to support myself. Just saying it now, I feel like tingly around my lips and a little moist around my eyes, because I'm feeling some tenderness toward myself now, toward this part of me that is feeling shame. And so that capacity, that skill to accompany yourself, can then be the foundation on which you begin to build this unpacking process. And the single most powerful thing that I have experienced and that I would recommend for folks in my own money journey is to have, again, about a bestie, a money bestie. For me, I went through trauma of money a number of years ago. There was a fellow therapist in the program. She's local to me in the same province. And we got on Voxer right away and literally every single day talked to one another about money. And we bring our most difficult, most shameful, most squidgy, most whatever you want to call them moments to one another. There are times when I've brought this to this person with my heart pounding and my mouth dry, but because we were committed to shedding light, like a compassionate, warm, to bathe in light our money experiences, like sharing it with her and having her say to me, yeah, and you can be trusted with money, which is a line from the trauma of money, right? And we just repeat back and forth to one another, you can be trusted with money. Yeah, I get how that could be difficult. You can be trusted with money. I get how that could be difficult. The system is fucked and it's not your fault. And you can be trusted with money. To me, shining light on it that way with a compassionate listener, whether it's a trained professional or a peer you trust, is the single most powerful tool we have for beginning to unpack our money shame.
I love that so much. And it's funny, as you're talking, I do a lot around money mindset because obviously part of fundraising is you have to talk about money.
Yeah.
And a lot of times I'll have folks that I'm training will say things like, I just need to get over it. And it, even like that phrasing hurts me because it's like continuation of the violence against self. Of like,
Yes.
Oh, my emotions don't matter. This trauma I've experienced doesn't matter. I just need to suck it up and get on with it. And so I love this approach of self-compassion and really feeling what's in your body. Because I think the other thing that I'd love to talk about as well is a practice of feeling in your body. Because for a long time, I just thought my body was a fancy container for my brain. I was like, it's all about my brain. And I didn't realize until I started doing somatic coaching with a friend of mine that like my body actually is telling me a lot of things.
Yeah.
I got very good at just ignoring it, especially those intuitive gut feelings. I think we all have that thing of, oh, I just knew it in my gut. But we tend to be very good at overriding our gut because we're like, it's all about the brain. So I'm wondering if you could walk us through one of the practices that you share for folks listening who might want to assist on their own.
Yeah. So I'll say first, like you, I was all in my head. My childhood was a situation where I had to use my head. The tool I had at my disposal was my head, my brain. And so I used it to figure out how to navigate very difficult circumstances. And so I was always the one in the room who, when people would talk about body, I'd be like, body, what body? Obviously, when I have a toothache, I feel that. Obviously, when something, but beyond that, my like people would talk about relating to and sensing into. And I'm like, what even are you talking about? Okay. So if that's your situation, I totally see you. And I want to say, first of all, that so much of this is easier said than done. It's an experiential process, and it helps to have a coach, whether it's a therapist, a trained somatic therapist, or a somatic coach, or a somatic body worker, who can help you cultivate the relationship with the data that's there in your body. What I would invite as a first skill is the practice of noticing. And you'll remember that I mentioned about I'm noticing something in me is feeling shame or is having a shame experience. That noticing practice, which is like taking an inventory, it's without the discursive or evaluating process on top of it. For example, a person might say, I feel anxious. That's discursive and evaluating. What we're looking for is I'm noticing something in my stomach is feeling. Actually, I don't. Right now, I'm just going with what I'm having in my own body as a way of demonstrating. Because I wasn't noticing anything in my belly, but I sure noticed a fluttery feeling in my chest as I started to get concerned about doing this fast enough for the purpose of what we're doing here today. When I first was noticing sensory data in my body, there wasn't anything coming. I started to get worked up about, oh my goodness, I have to do this fast enough here. And then came the fluttery sensation in my chest. And that's a description. So I'm using descriptive words to support me in coming into contact with what's happening here. And when you come into contact in a descriptive and noticing kind of way, that can support what's there in unfolding and providing you with what it knows about your experience. With the granularity, like anxious, especially if you're an anxious person, it's just, there's no granularity to that. It's just, I'm anxious all the time. I'm asleep anxious. I'm awake anxious. It's anxious. And we can get really intimate with the nuances of our sensory experience that give us detailed information. But again, it's a practice. And it's exceptionally hard to do when you're on your own because isolation is a it can register as a threat in your physical body. And so just having a companion, a friend who can sit with you, doesn't even have to guide you, but just a friendly presence while you practice. Oh, I'm just noticing what's happening in my body right now. I'm sitting in a harder chair and I had hip replacement surgery last year, and I'm noticing a little bit of sensation there in my right hip. And the discursive might be, something's wrong, right? And there is a part of me that is concerned that maybe something's wrong. But again, I'm noticing the territory. So this noticing is a version of self-compassion.
And then, sorry to interrupt you, but...
No, go ahead.
When we did this practice, the thing that I also noticed is that in closing it, you thanked your body.
Yes.
And I thought that was so powerful, because so often we don't express gratitude for our bodies. We only notice our bodies when something goes wrong. But we often don't acknowledge when things are going right, or when if it's giving me information, I'm like, shut up, body.
Yes, that's right. I don't want to hear that.
Yeah. So how might we end this practice, please?
Sure. So again, to be straight up, not every time are you going to feel any kind of gratitude to what comes. It might be difficult to hear what comes. And so you want to check first. I would invite you to check first. Do I even feel gratitude? And you may not feel gratitude. And so you may not feel like thanking. You may want to simply acknowledge what came, to say, I'm acknowledging that all this stuff came. The next little step toward gratitude, if you want to be grateful but still aren't feeling grateful, is to say, I appreciate that they were here, that they came forward, they being the parts, the data, the information. I'm appreciating that they took the time to come. You might not appreciate what they told you, but you can stay at the level of appreciating that they came. And you may find that after those two steps of acknowledging and appreciating, that you might feel a little bit of warmth as well. And then if the warmth comes, you could be like, oh, yeah, and I guess I am grateful for what they shared with me because it was important information. Not that I like it necessarily, but because it was important. So you'll find with me, if you talk to me at length, there's always a nuance around things, because it's important not to force to be like, oh, yes, I should be grateful. If you're not grateful, don't be grateful.
Yeah.
No problem. Just acknowledge. That's okay.
And I will say, having done this practice with you, I found that even saying the things out loud and feeling it in my body, it really calmed my nervous system. It was just okay. I can like acknowledge it, and then I didn't have to hold it like in my shoulder.
Yeah.
You know, it was like,
Yes.
Okay. We have a couple questions coming in, and then we will wrap it up. Shula, we could talk to you forever, but Shay has a great question. Shay, do you
Sure. I'm just wondering, especially because it can be such a sensitive topic, if we do start recognizing and noticing money shame in others that have a direct impact on our fundraising abilities and our budgeting overall for our nonprofits, such as board members, how do we navigate that?
I love this question, Shay. And I would say, not to be beating the drum for the Trauma of Money program, but I would really recommend it, because if as an organization, the folks there can be trained in this approach and then accept that as a community, as an organization, we together are going to approach things in this way, it can make it more acceptable to be more direct around things like shame. But let's say that's not the case. And let's say that you're in a board meeting and something comes up and you notice somebody's having a shame attack, or that shame is present. We don't have to use the word shame, because sometimes that just like, whoa, to be seen for your shame can make you even, can elicit even more feelings of shame. But we can say something like, I'm noticing this is a tender moment, or I'm noticing there are emotions here around this. And then you can invite folks to, in the trauma of money and also in trauma work generally, we have the concept of the window of resilience or the window of tolerance. It's a concept of capacity. There's an upper and a lower limit of capacity. And that when we are outside our capacity, our resources are then very narrow on survival and unable to take in other information. And so when a person is having a shame attack, we can assume that they're outside their window of resilience and don't have much capacity to really be with whatever's happening in the moment. So we can invite a window of resilience practice in this moment. And you'll see that I did a couple. One was taking a breath. Another was giving myself a gentle touch. But if you are the kind of person and have the kind of board, or you can even maybe take the risk and say, hey, I learned this new thing. I think it's going to help us. It's a somatic practice that can support us. And then you can introduce any of a number of different kind of window of resilience practices. For example, simply putting your chin, if this is accessible to you physically, to put your chin over your right shoulder. And you can invite everybody to just do this along with you, to put your chin over your right shoulder and very slowly moving your head from one side to the other, not only for looking around the room as you do, but also there's something about this particular movement that enables the nervous system to calm down somewhat. And then you can come back to the discussion. You can even just invite people to shake it off. You can just, I notice there's a lot of emotion here. You can invite them to stand up in their seat and shake it off. There are a number of different ways that you can help people come back into their window of resilience and then come back to the question at hand without ever naming and doing shame work with them. But honestly, like a more holistic approach is, as an organization, to talk about, hey, we know money is a thing. We know how money affects us living in capitalist culture. And we want, as an organization, to at least introduce some window of resilience practices and maybe some concepts around shame and money shame into our organization so that we can relate to one another and to money and to our vision in a way that is life serving. That would be, I think you'd get more, I was going to use a militaristic metaphor, but I'm not now and I'm struggling for a different one. It would be richer and more fulfilling to do it that way. Shay, how is that? How does that come? How does that land at your end?
That feels great. I love the approach of removing the word shame and just saying, I see this as a touchy or heightened topic for everyone. I really love those recommendations. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. We have time for one last question coming in from Holly.
And, hi, Holly. So
Holly is talking about negotiating salary. And I also think for fundraisers, this gets into how much do I ask and feeling like I'm going to ask low because maybe we feel like we're not worthy of it or we're going to get rejected or so on. So Holly, do you want to unmute yourself and ask this very excellent question?
Yes, thank you. I'm so excited to have this opportunity right now as I'm applying for jobs because salary can be all over the place in fundraising and places are not very transparent about what they're offering. And so they're wanting me to put out a range in. I'm doing all the techniques. And then also around that, I have some shame around that sometimes I'm applying for these jobs where even though I have 25 years of experience, I do not have a degree. So to me, it makes me lowball myself a lot of times. And so I was wondering how you navigate around that.
So I'd like to offer something and then I'm going to throw it to Ria because I think you will have something important to say around the dynamics of nonprofits and the job process. So for me, what I found around questions of value and worth, when we're told, ask what you're worth, charge what you're worth, when we're trauma survivors, either directly in our personal lives or when we think about it in terms of the culture in which we live, our worth and value is always under threat. And it takes a lot of work to reconcile and heal these attacks on our worth. And so, yes, of course, that's important work and it takes a long time and isn't helpful to somebody who has to apply for a job tomorrow. Over the long term, you might want to think about that. And in the short term, another thing to think about that is somewhat less difficult to unpack in your mind is the question of sustainability. And so I ask for what my fee requests are around sustainability. I know what it is that I need to sustain my life and my business. And sustainability is a universal human principle that is, or value, we could call it, or need, that exists independent of time, culture. It's a universal human need, sustainability. Like really life, right? It's about, sustainability is like a euphemism for life, for living, right? Who doesn't want to live, right? Who doesn't want life in general as a human? We all do. Plants do, everything does. Life matters to us. And so when we talk in the business world, we can use the word sustainability. My sustainability matters and your sustainability matters. And this is what I'm requesting to support my sustainability. And what's helpful for me when I have conversations with clients and prospective clients, and they say, oh, I can't afford your fees. I say to them, sustainability really matters to me. And I'm so celebrating that what matters to you for sustainability and where your boundaries are around sustainability. And I totally celebrate that you're clear about that. And let me connect you with folks whose sustainability needs might be more in line with yours. And it's a whole destigmatizing conversation around money. So with salary stuff, if you can come to some place of feeling in right relationship with issues of sustainability for yourself, and that and tie that to a number that feels good for your sustainability, right? Like in integrity for you, then you can come from this place of, yeah, sustainability matters. I know it matters to me, and I know it matters to this agency. And if they decline my salary request, I can, of course, there's the whole thing of I didn't get the job, which in some cases can be very real because it means you don't have money to pay your bills. But putting that aside and speaking only about this issue around salary expectations, we can then say to ourselves, it's not that I ask too much. It's that my strategy for sustainability is not a good fit with their strategy for sustainability. And I'm going to find an organization where there's a better match around our sustainability strategies. And that doesn't make my sustainability strategy wrong. It just means that there's not a good fit with this organization, and I'm going to look for a better fit. How's that go over, Holly?
Fantastic. Yes. I love looking at it from that approach. Yes. Thank you.
And Rhea, did you want to say something about nonprofits and salary transparency and all that kind of stuff?
I do. Thank you so much, Lou. So I will say here in New York City, they are required to put salary on the job description. And I hope that is a trend that other folks, other states adopt. That was a beautiful answer. My answer is a little less, I would say, generous in the sense that a couple things. I think always be a buyer. So Holly, in your case, if you're doing development, everyone is a development person. So you're actually in the driver's seat on this one, especially with 25 years of experience. And then the other thing I would offer is I have a strategy called the What Would Chad Do strategy. So oftentimes
Chad?
Yeah, Chad being the mediocre white man who fills up work.
Yes.
Chad. So I asked myself, what would Chad do? Because I'm, in a sense, borrowing that level of confidence. And I will just say, when I was running a nonprofit, it was routinely white men who would ask me for raises, completely divorced from their outcomes. I just thought, what would Chad do in this situation? Holly, what I might recommend for you, and this is what I used to do when I bid out proposals, is I would put the number that I, Rhea, would charge, and then I would add 30% on top of it as a Chad tax. And send it in before I could second guess myself. What would Chad do?
I love that. Oh, to have the confidence of a mediocre white man.
Yeah.
Can I just say that my least favorite boss who fired me over Zoom's name was Chad. And it was Ann. And so now I definitely am going to do what would Chad do. I just had to interject that. Sorry.
I love that. Don't apologize. What would Chad do? Because the thing is, and again, taking into account all of the legacy of racism and sexism and white supremacy and patriarchy and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, I also think like white men get more because they ask more. They ask bigger. They think that they're entitled to it. So we should also feel that we're entitled to it, because what I found is that women in general are overqualified and they're underqualified. And the reverse is true of men, which is that they're underqualified, but they think they're overqualified. So let's borrow some of that mediocre white man confidence.
Yes, we are absolutely entitled, I would say, to life and sustainability. This is our entitlement. It's our birthright. And when I say sustainability, I don't mean rice and beans sustainability, a rich life, a rich and satisfying, thriving life that for sustainability, and you get to define what your own sustainability is. And Chad has his idea, and Shay put in the chat, Chad tax. I'm all about that. Yes, I will support that. They believe that they are entitled to a certain level of sustainability, and their sustainability is like all the benefits and bonuses and perks and all that stuff. That sustainability is much for them as it is for us. And we, those of us who are not mediocre white men, can get fierce about our own sustainability and say, yeah, I deserve that, and I'm going to ask for it.
And last thing I'll say, Shayla, to your point about abundance versus scarcity, we have to get ourselves out of this mind trap that a dollar for me means a dollar less for you. Like, just because I make money doesn't mean that there's less money for you, right?
Yeah.
And I think women get into this mindset of self-sacrifice. Okay, like I can't ask for that, or that's too much, or oh, who am I to ask for such a thing? There's a lot of money in this world. And just because you're making money doesn't mean that there's less money for someone else. In fact, I think that there's more money, there's more flow, there's more energy.
Yes, this comes back to the Tom principle of increasing discernment. We are led to believe that there isn't enough for us, those of us who don't have access to money and power and privilege, right? The nature of the system in which we live obscures from us what is actually there. And part of increasing discernment is to say, like you say, Rhea, there's lots there. There is plenty. The problem is that some people are hoarding it, not that there is not enough.
Yeah, I would say it's a distribution problem. It's not a volume problem. Shula, my friend, this has been so wonderful. I really appreciate you. I'm going to make sure to put your information in the show notes for folks who want to get in contact with you. Are you also, do you want people to connect with you on LinkedIn? What platform, if they want more Shula in their life, how can we get more Shula?
Sure. The two platforms where I'm really active are LinkedIn, and my name is distinct. You can find it very easily. Then on Instagram, I'm the Entrepreneur's Therapist, and those links will be in the show notes as well.
Fabulous. Thank you, my friend. This has been a lot of fun. And I think if this is resonating with you, get in touch with Shula. You probably need a therapist. Thanks so much, everyone. Take care. If you like this and have found this to be resonating for you, please take a moment on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcast and leave a review. Thanks so much.